I'll start with my quote that I said last night. We'll probably hear this every morning, but it's from David White, and it's anger is the deepest form of compassion. That we got to think about that for a moment. Anger, that thing that we hate so much about ourselves, anger is the deepest form of compassion. So we're trying to be compassionate beings. We need anger in order for that to happen. Could we all say that? I need anger in order to be compassionate. So anger is the deepest form of compassion for another, for the world, for the life, for the self, for a life, for the body, for a family, and for all our ideals, all vulnerable, and all possibly about to be hurt. I mean, without anger, we would not move to do anything to help the Ukrainian people. We may not can fix their situation, but without anger, we wouldn't even be moved to want to do anything about it, help out, send money, you know. Stripped of physical imprisonment, this is back to David White, stripped of physical imprisonment and violent reaction, anger is the purest form of care. The internal living flame of anger always illuminates what we belong to, what we wish to protect, and what we are willing to hazard ourselves for. That's what anger is. Why in God's name would we ever want to get rid of that? Right? We don't. We need it as human beings to make a better world. But anger is glued and tied together oftentimes with aversion. And that aversion is the problem. It's the clinging greed aspect of anger. And so that it's the aversion I want to talk about this morning. A little bit about it. Where's my Thich Nhat Hanh put it a different way. I'm gonna give you two quotes that Thich Nhat Hanh said that I think says the same thing David White says. He said, root out the aggression in your life and learn to live compassionately and mindfully. Seek peace. When you have peace within, real peace with others is possible. Right? That's the first one. And the second thing he said is what I want to use to point us to move beyond this possibility that anger could be a form of compassion, then how do we get there? And the second quote he says is, for things to reveal themselves to us, we need to be ready to abandon our views about them. For things to reveal themselves to us, we need to be ready to abandon our views about them. He didn't say you have to abandon your views. You have to be ready to abandon your views. You have to be open, receptive to the possibility that your concretized view about something could be wrong. It could be mistaken, not clear. It could be confused. And so you have to be ready to abandon it. It's something that the Buddha said. I quote this all the time in my head just to keep a running thought about it. He said, in reliance on this, one abandons that. So another sutta says, in dependence on this, one abandons that. Right? Dependence on this, you abandon that. In reliance on this, you abandon that. So what Thich Nhat Hanh is saying is that if you, in order for you to actually see something new, then the way that you currently perceive it, you have to be ready to abandon that. You don't have to abandon it first. Let go of everything I know about anger, and now I'm ready for whatever. It's just that you have to be ready, open. That's what I want you to consider today, is to be open to the possibility that maybe your understanding of anger or aversion or the whole process can be differently. You can understand something or see something differently. So a framing, another framing before we actually talk about aversion is this early this morning, we were talking about how, this topic brings up, it attaches to a lot of our traumas, really. It's connected. It's not trauma itself, but it is sticky, like we were talking about last night. It's an expander. It's a trickster. So it's woven in with a lot of our traumas. And anger is our way of protecting ourselves from a lot of trauma. And so whether that anger is turned inward or outward, it's still our protection. And so the idea in the mind of getting rid of anger can probably stir up a lot of like, no, we can't do that. We'll be just totally exposed. No. That's unacceptable. And so some of you may have had dreams or thoughts of, you know, like, oh my God, what am I doing? I gotta stop. You know, it's fear driven. It's not you. It's just the mind's protective mechanism. So there are four ways. I think it's four. There are four ways that we can frame what we're about to do, like a box we can put it in, so that the mind is not overly traumatized, so that the mind is not overwhelmed by what it hears and what it sees. And I added this piece into this weekend because I learned when I was at Spirit Rock that people got triggered far faster than I expected them to, and so I want to start with this framing so that we all have an understanding of what we're doing here. So any retreat, whether it's a non-residential, it's a residential, any kind of extended practice period, we are going to create a relationship with the hindrances in general, all five of them: desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. All of that is going to show up as soon as we do some extended practice. It's inherent in extended practice. So I think of retreats as basically getting, building a relationship with the hindrances, building a relationship with understanding the hindrances and getting intimate with them. So that in and of itself is what's going to happen this weekend. We're going to have periods where we're meditating and we're sleepy, and periods of meditating and we're extra restless, periods of meditating and we want to do something else, periods where we don't want to do this. I mean, periods where I'm not sure I know how to do this practice. I don't know if I can do it. It's just all part of it. So we want to keep that realization that that's part of your birthright as a practitioner. That's your heritage as a practitioner, not you individually. You wouldn't, if it's almost like you have to be grateful that you have the hindrances showing up. You're like, woo, that means I'm practicing. That's why they're here. If I wasn't really practicing, they wouldn't be here. So the four things I want us to begin to think about is, one, don't take this discussion around the hindrances personally. It's not about you personally. We're talking generally about a energy, a process that happens in the mind. It happens in the body-mind synchronicity. It's not you personally. So don't take what we're saying personal. We're going to use our personal experiences as a way of understanding something that's not personal. But it's not, we're not talking about we are talking about our personal lives, but it's not a reflection of who you are personally. It's a reflection of how the human condition is showing up in your life, but it's not you personally that we're talking about. So don't take a lot of this, what you see, personally. The second part is, if we don't take it personally, is we have to let go of any kind of self-evaluation. When we get caught in a self-evaluation, like evaluating what I see about me, then we can create a lot of attachment to either not be that way or to become a better person. And then we end up less in the state of, being, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, ready to abandon our views. We begin to just throw it out and let's do something else. Let's go this way. And we don't really see the wisdom. The wisdom of it can't reveal itself because our self-evaluation gets in the way. So be careful about self-evaluation. It's more like you could say, I see this thing, this conditioning that I do, I see that. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I can see something. And that might, in and of itself, mean it's calls for more evaluation, more investigation, I mean, not evaluation. So more investigation into this to see why it arises and see what it's attached to. And we can begin to see it. The fact that you notice anger, or we're going to be noticing our anger this weekend. So the fact that you notice anger, the fact that you notice behavior patterns, habit patterns, ways I am, you may even notice, oh my God, I think it was last weekend, somebody noticed their kids had been telling them, Mom, you're like really, really difficult. You're really, you know, you're cold and mean, and it's hard to relate to you. She's like, no, I'm not like that. And then during this weekend, they realized, oh shit, I am cold when I'm angry. And then it's like, don't get caught in that and then think that there's something wrong with you. What you're seeing is human conditioning, but you're seeing it. And when we see human conditioning, that coldness doesn't come because they're just a bad person. That coldness comes because when they were little, they learned that coldness is the way I should be. Who knows why a four-year-old decides coldness is the way I should be? I think it's because I watched my parents and that's the way they were. So me too. You know, anybody that has kids, you see, they just watch you. They watch you, watch you, watch you, watch you, watch you, and then all of a sudden they do it. I'll never forget. We thought my nephew was injured in some way because he started, his eyes started blinking rapidly, and it was just this weird way that he was being, and we were all in a freak out. And then my mother came in the room. And she goes, oh, no, he's winking. He's working on his winking. Because she keeps winking at him. We thought there was something happening to him. And he is working on his winking because she always winks at him. Oh, my God. Scared the living daylights out of us. But this is what babies do. They watch us and then they copy. So the something as cute as winking, that's one thing, right? Or learning how to walk, that's one thing. But they learn our behavior patterns, our habit patterns that are harmful also. They learn the same thing. So much of what we do is not us. It's what we learn to do because we watched other adults doing it. And so now we do it. And to try to disrupt that is somehow, it's difficult. So we can't hold what we see as speaking about us so much. It's really just speaking about seeing the human condition. And then the last thing, even though we don't want to take all of this personally, we want to take it seriously. It is serious. And aversion, especially what we're going to talk about this weekend, it causes a lot of harm, a lot of harm. And we don't intend to harm as much as we do, but we do a lot of harm because we refuse to look at this kind of aversive way of being in the world. And even if that harm is a lot to ourselves, it is not fair for us to harm ourselves, and it's not fair for us to harm other people. You are not somehow more sacred or holy because you hurt yourself so badly and you don't hurt anyone else. And I'm not more, you know, charismatic because I hurt other people rather than hurting me. It's harm, period. And so we have to take it seriously, this harm, and learn how to eliminate, diminish, cut out that hurting that's going on in our behavior. And to do that, we have to see some unpleasantness. And that unpleasantness and that the challenges and the difficulties that we're living out of, we got to see it, but we can't take it personal. So this is sort of like threading the needle, but that's the way we got to do it. We have to see the truth of how we're being, not take it personal, not evaluate ourselves as somehow being wrong or right or good or bad, but hold it as this is the human condition, and it's dangerous. It's serious, and it needs to be uprooted. And so that's the way I want to approach this weekend. So I'm going to talk a little bit about aversion here. Aversion is, it's what probably the simplest way you could say it is, it's an unhealthy or inappropriate relationship with the unpleasant. So I'm reading a book called Knowing, Feeling and Knowing, Making Mind Consciousness. Or actually, he says Making Minds Consciousness. This is part of my nine bodies reading. Anyway, it's about from a neuroscientist, Antonio Damasio. I've read some of his other stuff before. But anyway, I've just started it, so I can't really give you a whole big rundown about whether it's a good book or not. It is a scientist that's writing it, though. I will tell you that part. But there's one thing that he articulated that I think it's very common, but it's very important with aversion, when you're going to talk about aversion. So we have a body that naturally knows how to send out alarm signals. So if you're hungry, the body has to send you a jolt of pain so that you personally know you're hungry. Otherwise, how would you know? There's all kinds of feelings that are just sort of out there. And how would you know what something is unless your body spoke to you about it? So going to sleep, hunger, you know, some danger situation, you know, something that's heavy and it'll hit on your foot, and that if it drops on your foot, it's going to be painful. I mean, there are these physical sensations of unpleasantness that we in this human body have to have. It is a necessary thing, these feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. It's a way for us to gauge as we're walking how things are. When my mother had breast cancer, and she had her breast removed, and I think they removed part of the lymph nodes or something. I don't know what it is that they removed. But I remember her saying one time that it was a weird experience that she couldn't feel pain in like her arm and stuff. So that if she burned herself with the, this is what it was. She burned herself with the iron. The tip of the iron burned her arm. And I saw this burn on her arm, and I said, where did that come from? And she goes, I totally had my arm resting up against the iron. I didn't even know it. It wasn't until I started smelling something's on fire. And it was like, that's my arm. She didn't know She didn't know sensory that that was there. So you can see that we need the feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. We need that sensory experience for us to stay alive, for us to, as human beings, to move in the world. But what ends up happening is our thinking mind, the ordinary egoic mind, begins to attach itself to all kinds of things that we don't like. I don't like it if I get too cold. I'm not dangerously cold, but the chill, I don't like that. I don't like peas. My son doesn't like peas. I've tried many ways to get him to eat them, but it's not going to happen. He's not going to eat the peas. I love peas. I think they're just so sweet. They're so good. He hates them. So we can't, it's not the peas, but this ordinary egoic mind that we have can take almost all simple things and turn it into, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And it will react as viscerally with I hate peas as it does with a dangerous situation, or you need to get something to eat, or whatever. These impulses of pleasant, unpleasant, and neither, they come at us pretty rapidly. And over our lifetime, we have cultivated some strong habits in relationship to them. So the mind will push us towards aversion about something that we don't even know that we've seen. Sort of like, I used to make my lunch at this lunch bar when I was working in the prosecutor's office. And I don't like those beets that have that red juice on them. It just, my mother used to eat them and she used to make us eat them, and I hate them, hate them, hate them. And this guy, the way the lunch, the way the salad bar was set up, the beets were like three layers up. This guy goes and gets the beets, and the juice from those beets is dripping all the way down on all this three other two layers of ingredients that you put on the salad bar. I saw that and I was done. I couldn't eat. I couldn't get my salad. I threw the whole thing away and I left. It was just, I was done. Because, not because I was done, not because anything was so terrible, but because the mind shut down any possibility of me eating anymore. That's the kind of mind we have. It will shut us down. It will cut us off. It will control our every existence if it sees something it doesn't like, or it wants, it doesn't want something, or it thinks you should have something. It will force you to go and get it. This is the mind we're working with. It's quite controlling. So the idea that we are just going to go to this mind and say, cut it out now, cut that out, you're causing too much trouble, is it's just foolishness. It's not going to happen. We have to come to understand this way that aversion works. So the level of aversion that I want to talk about with anger is more like hatred. It's an unwholesome root of hatred. It is when aversion gets attached, basic aversion, I don't like, gets attached and creates an enemy of something. It is a complete resistance of something. It's a rejection. So it is not, it is an absolute wrongness. This is why it's difficult to talk about anger, because immediately the mind will whisper to you, so does that mean you have to like Putin? Does that mean we have to be friends with Trump? Do we have to agree with all the racist people now? Do we have to love everybody? That's where it goes to, because it will not it will not allow you to veer into the harm side of it. Instead, it will go to all the beings and all the people and all the situations where you think it was just flat out wrong. It will go there and it will say, oh, you got to watch it. You can't take this because that means you're going to have to love everybody. That's not what it is. I like the Pali word for aversion. Definition of that is I think it's called pigata. Pataga. I don't know. Pataga. 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 I don't really know how to pronounce Pali very well. But it means striking against. Striking against. That's what it means. So what we are basically doing with any of our aversion, and then quite more importantly, the hatred, is we are striking against something. You got to get that physical, that visceral energy in the mind. You're striking against something, hitting someone is what you're actually doing in the mind. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. It's that kind of energy. So a better, more softer, rather than the mind of a knife stabbing, I hate you, I hate you, a softer, kinder way to envision the striking against. I'll give you a Zen story. I think it's a Zen story. It might be a sutta, but I can't remember. So I heard it as a story. So this monk goes out in a boat into a serene lake, and he begins to meditate, and he gets into a deep level of samadhi. It's a peaceful, and the birds and gentle breeze is quite beautiful, and he's going into deep, deep, deep samadhi. And then someone in a boat begins to strike his boat. This boat begins to strike his boat. So he's meditating and he's okay. He's like, I'm not even getting caught up in that. But the boat just keeps bumping up against his boat, and he's getting really upset now. Like, I'm meditating here. Boat keeps hitting him, hitting him, hitting him. And then he gets very upset and he decides, that's it. This is what level of disrespect can someone have to see a monk out here practicing and not have the decency to watch what they're doing. So he opens his eyes and he turns to tell the person to not, and he looks and the boat is empty. The boat had just unhooked from the dock, and it was floating around, and it was striking up against his boat by way of the waves, the current, just striking his boat. And all of that rage was pointed at an empty boat. Empty boat. You see that? That's what we're doing. That is a better image than maybe the, you know, got the knife out, chopping somebody up. You're striking at an empty vessel is what you're doing. And all of that anger, even when you're striking at yourself, you're striking at an empty vessel. It's empty. It's just the conditionings that keeps hitting us. And we are striking at an empty vessel. So that's one way to think about it. So it can show up as unpleasantness in the body, because we want the body to feel pleasant all the time. And when it doesn't, any kind of unpleasantness, we want it to go away. So we have this insatiable need to get it to go away. That's it. So if I'm standing in the grocery store and somebody's taking all day, or they're yelling about something, who knows nowadays, somebody's mad about something, I start getting irritated because I just want to go to, can I just go to the store and get out of here? But I'm now mad at them. I'm striking against them because I think they are the reason why I feel unpleasant. But what I hope we begin to see is that they are not the reason why we feel unpleasant. We are the reason why we feel unpleasant. And so that's what I want to talk about. So unpleasantness in the body, it shows up with obsessive or negative thoughts. So any kind of any kind of obsessive negative thinking, some of our stories that we get involved in and we spin in these stories, we are cultivating and strengthening our hatred, our aggression, our justification, our self-righteousness around why we're angry. And then it shows up, we don't necessarily see that obsessive thinking as hitting, but that's what you're doing. You are constantly hitting yourself every time you spin in that story over and over and over and over and over. And so it's beginning to get the visualization that that is a striking against, striking against, striking against, striking against. And is there a way we could disrupt that? And it shows up in difficult situations. You know, the situation itself is difficult, but we don't like it. We don't want it to be, you know, we get some difficult diagnosis, or I gotta wait for a diagnosis, or something bad happens. You know, my company is starting to lose money and I might lose my job. And we start having this kind of, I don't like the difficult situation. So we strike against that difficult situation, strike against that difficult situation. And it's foolishness. It's an empty vessel. It's not our fault that the situation is happening this way. And this is the way it is. And so rather than cultivate inner peace, we keep trying to strike against an empty vessel and make that boat not be there. As if somehow the boat did something wrong. Anyway, I think I've gone on way longer than I expected to go on, but that's okay. You know, we got to make sure we get a good understanding of aversion. So now let me tell you a little bit of how this practice is going to go. Every beginning of, for those of you that weren't here last night, we're going to have three sessions. Today, this morning, we're going to have a session this afternoon, and we're going to have a session tomorrow morning. So think of it as three sessions. And at the beginning of each of those sessions, I'm going to give a talk. We're going to just talk about, like I just did just now. We're going to talk about set up what it is that we're going to practice with. That's basically what I'm going to do. And then we are going to go into what's called a practice period to me. And I have found that on Zoom, if we don't frame the practice in such a way that it's not like when we're all in a room together and the only thing we can do is walking meditation. It's sort of like when we're in the room together, you're kind of left to walking meditation. But when you're at home, there's dishes to be done. I can get some coffee. I can go and take care of that stuff I needed to do. I got a break. Oh, I got some time. I can go deal with things that I need to do. And that is exactly what I want you to do. So during the sit, we are sitting. So we are going to train the mind to leave the sitting period for sitting. And we are going to let the walking periods be for contemplation. So we contemplate when we're moving and we are sitting. We're returning. That's the only requirement you have, is that when you're sitting, you're not going to carry on the contemplation discussion. And when you're moving, you can contemplate. And I'll give you various layers of things to contemplate. For today, to make today most stabilizing, during what we would normally call walking meditation times, I want you to literally do something. Go wash some dishes. Go pick up some things. Look over there, that place you wanted to organize those books, go over there and organize those books. I'm going to give you something to contemplate while you're organizing the books. But I want us to physically move so we don't get caught in dwelling on. And so there's a difference between contemplating this receptive, intuitive kind of thinking that we can do versus thinking about dwelling on and all of that. So if you haven't cleaned the bathroom, today is the bathroom cleaning time. So during one of the walking periods, go in that bathroom, clean the bathroom. And while you're cleaning the bathroom, you're going to consider this contemplation I'm going to give you. And so this tomorrow, we will be stiller, we'll be more settled. And tomorrow, we can do the more formal walking. If you want to do the formal walking, feel free to. You can walk outside, you can walk in the house, you can walk anywhere. So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying if you find yourself getting stirred up in this felt sense of thinking, then give the body something to do while you are contemplating and keep it on a more subtler level. But no matter what you do during walking, when we come back to sitting, we are just sitting. Do you have a question, Coral? When we come back to sit, we are just sitting. We are just sitting. We are just sitting. We are just sitting. And I'll give some guided meditations to help us settle, and then open up the space so we can actually contemplate something that the mind does not necessarily think it needs to contemplate. It thinks it's handling everything very well, thank you. We just live in a bad world. That's what's going on. It's not me. So this is the way we're going to do it, little bit by little bit. And then after we have a period of practice, so chances are it'll be like 10 minutes, it'll be like 20 minutes of sitting, and then I'd have to look at the timing a little bit here, but we'll do a sitting, we'll do a walking, we'll do a sitting, we'll do a walking, and then we'll come back. So the timing might be a little different depending on when I look at the clock here, just a second. And then at the end of that sit, walk kind of period, then we'll open it up for how the experience went. We'll just open it up. People share what's going on, questions, whatever, some things they want to know more, whatever it is. And then we'll go to lunch, and then we'll do the same thing in the afternoon. And then we'll call it an evening, and then we'll come back tomorrow morning and frame it similarly, but just a little bit different. All right. So that's how the weekend's going to go. So let us begin by taking 10 minutes, because you've been sitting here listening. You've heard all this stuff. We can't just dive in. So go get some tea, go do something, get some water, go and pee, go and do something else that's going to move the body. And we'll come back and we'll start our practice period. All right. Thank you so much. So let us start our sitting period here. I am going to take what's going to feel like poetry, but they're called Reflections of the Dhamma from Ian McCrory. It's Ian, and then his last name is spelled McCrorie. Ian McCrory's book, The Moon Appears When the Water is Still. So all the readings I'm going to read, I'm just going to read from that book. And you can get that book online as a PDF, or you can buy it. So the first one is, sitting does not create truth. Meditation does not produce insight, just as smelling a flower does not make it fragrant. The perfume of the rose is already there. We slow down to attend the unfolding and the flowering of its nature. Slowing down and attending to just this breath allows the reality of now to reveal its nature. Sitting still gives us the opportunity to witness the revealing of the truth. The moon appears only when the water is still. So, this first meditation is really about just coming into relationship with the body, just arriving here, nothing more. So let's get in a comfortable place that allows us to arrive. We can begin just by noticing the body sitting here. You can feel the body sitting here. We have a capacity that's a part of being human, this proprioceptive awareness of location. We can feel our location. So you can actually sense into where you are right now. And you know it. You have your eyes closed and you still know it. Because you know the location of now. So we're just gently feeling into the moment of now, arriving here, this moment, feeling the body sitting in the chair. You can feel the heaviness of the body. You know, there's a solid mass here that's sitting. Maybe feel the weight of the lower portion of the body sitting. If you're lying down, you can feel the weight of the body in its prone position. You can feel the legs and their heaviness on the ground. You can feel the weight of that heaviness from the underside of the legs, having a sense that the legs are being pulled down by gravity. The arms. If you put your attention on the sensory experience under of the underarm, this weight underarm, or the underside of the arms, the underside of the legs, you can begin to feel the weight of the body. Its heaviness, its solid, heavy mass sitting here. And even as you're sitting here, feeling the weight of this body, you can feel the softness of skin and flesh and the cushion that you're sitting on or the furniture you're laying on. You can still feel the hardness of the bones in the body. It's heavy, it's hard. We just want to be right here with this body. So noticing how you are arriving in this moment, aligning your attention here. Sort of when we close our eyes and we come into the heavy solidness of the body, it's like a seclusion away from the rest of the world. And we need that seclusion. We're not going to be behind the eyes secluded forever. We're just going to be secluded for a small amount of time. So there's a felt sense of turning away from everything else and just being here now, in this moment. Arriving here. Feel the body, the weight, and the hardness of bone. This is earth. It's the solidness of earth. It's an elemental nature that exists always around us. It's heavy, it's hard, it's firm, and it's relatively still. By its nature, it's foundational. So we're arriving into this moment, and we're letting the felt sense of earth give us the foundation to be here. So our eyes are closed and we may not see anything, but we are learning to open the wisdom eye and recognize we know where we are. I know what chair I'm sitting in. I know what piece of furniture I'm laying on. I know where I am, grounded in this moment. That's all we're doing in this first meditation, is returning the mind to the felt sense of being right here. I don't need to go anywhere else. Just feeling the quality of earth. It's stabilizing nature. It's like a giant mountain, a giant tree. It's rooted, solid, strong into this moment, right now. And if the mind wants to wander off into thinking about things, just gently bring it back to right here, mind and body together. Grounded in the earth, this moment, secluded from the rest of the world, tucked in, protected. We're not trying to get to any state of mind or any particular way of feeling. We just want to know over and over and over, I'm right here. I feel the groundedness. I feel the body. I feel its heaviness. You can put your attention on the sit bones in the pelvic area and feel the body actually sitting. Can feel the hardness of the bones and the bones in the feet, the legs, the arms, the back. Yeah, very solid. This is earth. Earth in its solid, relatively still capacity. To stay here with earth. Just over and over, feeling the bones, and the feet, the legs and the knees, pelvic, thighs, backbone, shoulders, arms, hands, fingers, bones in the head, so many bones in the body. It's like a body full of bones. Very hard and solid. We can feel the weight that grounds us here in this present moment. Very, very heavy. 50 pounds, 100 pounds, 200 pounds, 300 pounds, whatever that weight is, it's poundage. It's not ounces. It's grounded and rooted into this moment. We're pulled into this moment by gravity. And you can actually rest this body, this earth body, on earth itself. And see if you can let the whole body just relax and loosen and rest on earth. Nothing special, earth on earth. Just practicing connecting to the earth element, grounded in this present moment. We're not worried about anything else. We don't have to be. We're secluded. We're connected to just this moment. The here-ness of now. We know where we are. We know who we are in this moment. We are earth element. It's heavy, it's hard, it's firm, it's relatively still by nature. I don't have to do anything to make that be. We are not contemplating, thinking about. We are feeling the sensory experience of Earth over and over again, reconnecting over and over with the felt sense of Earth, the qualities of heaviness and hardness, this firm, solid mass that's relatively still. Sitting does not create truth. Meditation does not produce insight. Just as smelling a flower does not make it fragrant. The perfume of the rose is already there. We slow down to attend the unfolding and flowering of its nature. Slowing down and attending to just this breath allows the reality of now to reveal its nature. Sitting still gives us the opportunity to witness the revealing of the truth. The moon appears only when the water is still. I will ring one bell. To signify that this sit is over and we are in the transition, but practice will continue until I ring three bells. So while the sit is a change in transition, our practice continues into walking or movement. There's no need to bow if you don't want to. You can if you want to, but we will bow at the end of our practice period. So we're going into walking now, and the contemplation is, how does anger show up for you? How does it show up in your life? So find something you can do, wash some dishes, tidy things up, something to have the ordinary mind, have something to do, while you just consider lightly, how does anger show up for you? And I'll ring a bell when it's time to return to sit. We'll have 20 minutes. By meditating, we are like the candle which says to the darkness, I beg to differ. Our quiet equanimity says to the overly zealous pontificators of opinion and views, I beg to differ. Our solitary renunciation says to the perverted promoters of sensual entertainment, I beg to differ. Our stellar resolve says to the salacious purveyors of instant gratification, I beg to differ. My meditation is a silent but powerful candle saying to all the forces of darkness, I beg to differ. So we've been moving about and we have been contemplating, and now we want to return to the stillness. To the relative stillness of this moment. Come into seclusion and let everything go. We don't have to carry it with us. There's no requirement to carry our thoughts with us into our meditation. So by closing our eyes, we are going into seclusion, away from, tucked into a completely different world, a world that's lit by intuitive thought and not the conceptualized views of things. So we're going to feel our way through when we close our eyes rather than think our way through. So we start by arriving in this moment, feeling into the here and now of it. Maybe you notice you're here and now because you can hear sounds. Maybe you notice you're here and now because you can feel your body not moving. You can feel your feet are not moving, your legs are not moving, and the torso, the arms. You feel the not movingness of the body. And there's another quality that we cultivate, which is a capacity to be receptive to whatever comes to us. We're not trying to make the moment or the meditation be a certain way. We just want to be receptive to whatever comes to us. And there's a cultivation of stability of the knowing you're here and now. And then there's the cultivation of the capacity to be open and receptive to whatever comes. In effect, this weekend, we don't want to teach the mind anything. We don't want to teach ourselves anything. We want to be open and let the wisdom come to us. So we're just solidly here now. And then we cultivate this capacity for openness, receptivity, being available for whatever wisdom comes to us. One way to begin to feel what it feels like to be available is to start with our earth element of grounding. And feel the body sitting here and the heaviness of the body. See if you can let go of holding yourself up and just let the body rest on the furniture. And the furniture is resting on the earth, so we're earth resting on earth. Get a sense of the felt sense of the hardness of bone. So we can feel earth as earth. We want to have a sense that we're here, we're now, we're solid, sitting. You can feel the relative stillness of the earth body. Can you feel that? Can you get a sense that when you're just solidly sitting here, not doing anything, that you can rest and let go, and the body holds itself up. The bones hold themselves up. And we can just feel the ever-present nature of now. If the mind wanders into thought, we let it go easily, softly, gently. We just let it go. We're in the realm of feeling right now. We want to know what's arising by how it feels, not by what we think about it. So we just keep returning to the world of the felt sense. And right now we want to feel the felt sense of the stillness of earth. And as we feel this body is not moving, you begin to notice that there is movement. You can feel the movement of the breath, the rocking, maybe of the whole body just rocking, or you can feel the movement of the breath in the belly's expansion or the chest is rising. There is an aliveness that's happening. I can feel it. There's a tingling that's going on. Sensations are pulsating, moving, pressure here and there changing. This aliveness is wind. It's the felt sense of wind, movement. It's as natural and as common as earth is. Everything in life can be both still and moving. And we can learn to feel that rather than getting caught up in the concept, we could just feel it as movement. So the body is still sitting here, lying here. And then there's movement. Breathing is happening. Sensory shifting, changing is happening. Sounds are moving. It's happening. We're just perceiving the movement itself. We don't care what it is that's moving, just the perception of wind as wind. No matter how the wind blows, the mountain, the earth is still steady and strong, still. Can you feel this? Can you feel the stillness of the body not moving? Can you get a sense, well, my legs are not moving, my arms are not moving, my hands, torso, still. And yet I feel this tingling aliveness and movement, breathing, energy flowing, sensations flowing, blood flowing. I feel pressure changing, nature of pressure. It's just movement. Sounds coming, going, movement. It's life. It's natural. It's the wind. We never think, oh, I don't want the wind around. We need it. So we just want to sit for this meditation and feel the solidness and stillness of the body, feel that you're not moving. Feel that you're just sitting here or just lying here. Feel that. What does it feel like, the body just giving to gravity? And allow the solidness, hardness, heaviness of this moment to just be as it is. I don't have to do anything. I'm in seclusion, I'm practicing. But the felt sense of stillness of earth, the grounding nature of earth, and the alive nature of wind, I'm practicing. Noticing movement as a contrast, breathing, sensations, sounds. We're practicing learning to intuit the felt sense of this body. You may notice thinking, and that thinking is movement. You don't care what the thoughts are. Body is still just sitting here, just lying here, grounded, rooted like earth. And then there may be some thinking, some thoughts passing through, just movement like clouds passing around a mountain. Doesn't affect the mountain. This is what we're practicing with right now. Stillness and movement. Can you feel the aliveness still? The steadiness, the solidness of the body, the earth, the earthness of body. Can you get that you always have stability around you? You always are grounded. You're always connected to earth. And yet, there is always movement. There's always some kind of aliveness. And the wind is everywhere. It's a light breeze sometimes. It's a torrential wind. Storm. But it's still just wind. And it doesn't do anything to the stability of earth. Can you hear sound? It's just movement. It doesn't mean anything. You can't make the sound come. You can't make it stop. You don't know how long it'll be. It's just sound that arises into your perception. That's what movement is. It's phenomena that arises and passes away. This arising and passing away is its aliveness. We don't want to get rid of the aliveness. We just want to not be caught in it. By meditating, we are like the candle which says to the darkness, "I beg to differ." Our quiet equanimity says to the overly zealous pontifications of opinions and views, "I beg to differ." Our solitary renunciation says to the perverted promoters of sensual entertainment, "I beg to differ." Our stellar resolve says to the salacious purveyors of instant gratification, "I beg to differ." My meditation is a silent but powerful candle saying to all the forces of darkness, "I beg to differ." For this walking period, this movement period, this period to find something to do, the contemplation is, what troubles you about anger? What scares you about it? What are you afraid of about anger? Just consider that as a contemplation while you're doing something, while you're moving about, maybe a walk, maybe a wiping down the cabinets. What troubles you about anger? What scares you about it? What are you most afraid of? We'll come back at 11:30. Well, we have a few minutes and we can kind of see where you're at. This is what I want to leave you with. This is what we've been doing all morning. One monk said to his companion, "It is so good to walk alone." Replied his companion, "Precisely. It is so good to be with you too." Right? This is the Dhamma, he says. Total alonement, total aloneness, and total intimacy. When I walk by myself, everyone is with me. And when everyone is walking with me, I am alone. Do you see this? This is what we're cultivating here. Both this aloneness, everybody's practicing with their own unique situation, and togetherness. We're beginning to see the ordinariness of this, the humanness of this. And because of the humanness, we can all practice with our individual circumstances.